Hi, this is Dr. Carl Goldkamp. If you're interested in learning about the ketogenic diet like I was, to save my own life, then this is probably the podcast for you. 8 years ago, I knew nothing about it. 6 years ago, it saved my life. 3 years ago, I started researching and talking with some of the authorities in the field and attending medical conferences about this to understand why and how keto so dramatically changed my and my wife's Judy's lives. The purpose of this podcast is to share our journey of discoveries with you and understanding how keto is so effective in improving so many different conditions, from obesity, epilepsy, diabetes, infertility, MS, Alzheimer's, heart disease, to name a few. So take a step away from all the hype you've probably heard and roll up your sleeves with me and join me weekly to explore this living miracle that anyone can access. We'll talk science, we'll talk food. We'll explore its history and evolution to today, which is that the sheer wonder of the ketogenic way of eating has changed untold number of lives, unlike anything before it. And in case I forget to mention it, please join our Facebook group, Keto Naturopath. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp, and welcome back to another episode of the Keto Naturopath. Well, the first thing I have to say this is the second time I'm doing this particular podcast. I did have it done and it was about to be released, and I just thought it was just not the quality that I was very comfortable in releasing. Content quality, that is, not audio quality. And so I thought about it and decided to do it again, which put me behind. But since this is an unmonetized podcast, there's not much I have to lose. Haha. So there you go. What I want to do, so the topic for today is lipedema. So it's an actual condition. So some of you are wondering what the heck this is, and others who have lipedema are wondering if there's something you can do about it. So let me go a little bit into the condition for the general audience, and after that, we'll talk about keto relative to lipedema and its application. And yes, I do think it could be a big deal. And after that, I'll look at more general and sort of philosophical approach to how you would treat such a condition and why you would look in that direction. And this is probably the philosophy, and therefore the treatment with that philosophy in mind, is the big bifurcation, is the big difference between what we call alternative medicine and conventional medicine. And I think naturopaths really bridge that gap, because we have all the licensure for all the blood work and the imaging studies and so on and so forth. And in some states, you can do the antibiotics or not, but we have that training. So it's part of how we practice. So we're not way over there just with crystals. We're very much into biochemistry, more so than conventional medicine. And I don't mean for this to be, hey, go to your local naturopath. I'm just saying education makes a difference. Really, education makes a difference. And then how you practice makes a difference. The idea of functional medicine is a slight tangent, is really the bridging of naturopathic medicine onto MDs who were dissatisfied with how they were trained. And that's how my take is on that. I started with Jeffrey Bland and the Institute of Functional Medicine. And for those who attended his conferences, the first thing he would say is he was one of the founders for Bastyr University, which is where I went. And having attended Bastyr and speaker of the class when I graduated, I never heard that. So what I'm saying is the relationship between functional medicine and naturopathic medicine clinically is very close. All right, that issue aside, back to lipedema. So lipedema is, by the word itself, is swelling the fat. It is primarily with women, and there have been men who have this condition, and it's about 98% women and a few percent of men. And it's an uncontrolled fat growth, if you will, and I'm paraphrasing it so I don't get wrapped up in the terminology too much, of certain parts of the body. So some people have their arms and back, upper back, as being something that's disproportionately obese. So it's like a localized obesity. Again, my words. And it crosses with an inflammatory condition. It crosses with a lymphedema, which is the swelling of the, not just the lymph nodes, but the whole lymph system. And we're going to remove any possible surgery cause. Okay. We're not going to talk about that here. We're going to say it came to certain people. So for women, you have its arms as an area, upper back as an area, primarily is what they call a gynoid area. So you can sort of guess which is from your waist, more or less where your navel is, down to halfway down your thighs, they get huge buttocks and thighs, and it's very uncomfortable for them, not just in terms of size, it's very sensitive. So it's a painful sensitivity, and some people get it below the knees. And so it varies by this area. What do they know? They feel, and there seems to be enough evidence that it's hormonally related. You can sort of say that because it's so gender specific. That qualifies it to be hormonally related. But they think that it really kicked in around the time of puberty. So when women start to show the secondary sex characteristics of being women. And that varies depending on the country and so on and so forth. But for the most part, it's anywhere between 11 to 18 years old, depending on family, location, etc. So at that point, it's when, gosh, they get a little heavier in some part of their body more than all their friends, or more than all their age-related women. So what else do they know? They know that there's some genetic predispositions, so you can look at that, and we know that there's various sensitivities that you can go quickly down the genetic rabbit hole and look for things like HLA-associated parts of their, in essence, autoimmune reaction that they're having. So there's a lot of lab work you can do. But, and I've come up through this rabbit hole, by the way, on a number of conditions. And, you know, I put less and less value there. So I'm not disparaging people who are wanting to get a handle on what can I do for lymphedema, for myself, for my daughter, for my sister, for whatever. Oh yeah, let me just give a few more facts here about lymphedema. So it's in 11% of all women, they know that's a fact, but it's speculated that it's as high as 40% in all women. So it's a big deal and it's very uncomfortable. It's a social block, it's a mobility block, it's a painful situation. So those who have lymphedema, they hurt and they want this to change. And so back to the rabbit hole, looking at all these things about predisposition and so on and so forth, I'm not saying they're not worth doing, but what happens is, and I'm now transitioning into the sort of the philosophy, you have to ask, you know, what are things like their inflammatory markers? And so you look for the bigger picture. So let's say this is one of many conditions that do have a high inflammatory, so CRP, SED rate, et cetera, and you go, well, gosh, well, inflammation is this nebulous sort of word that is also very valuable to have. And we tend to get more of it as we get older. It's also dietarily induced. Kind of know where I'm going with all this. But it is something that needs to be looked at. And autoimmune is an inflammatory condition that is the body. And this is how I look at it, and a lot of other people look at it too. When inflammation starts for whatever reason, it could be environmental, though that's kind of a minority and depends on what that toxin is that you've been exposed to or have accumulated over your lifetime, right? That's a bioindividuality is also your history. Where did you grow up? What were you exposed to? One. The other is, what is the kind of diet you have? What kind of diet did you grow up with until you became an independent adult and could choose for yourself? That's a big deal. It's the second bioindividuality. And then, of course, we have the genetic predispositions. But I find, just like the cancer study, if you go back to listening to the podcast of Thomas Siegfried, yeah, you look at, people tend to look at, oh, these are the genes that predispose for certain cancers. And some genes are highly correlated, you know, what they call a drivers, or very high drivers in that. So there's a close association. And it's not many, but it's never 100%. And others are very weak correlations. So it's sort of a soupy sort of thing of, gosh, you have these genes, you have a chance of having certain cancers, what are you going to do about it? Well, if you're living a healthy lifestyle, maybe none of that will kick in. Back to Thomas Siegfried, to use that as an example for a second, the whole basis there, and I'm paraphrasing again, is that it is a mitochondrial breakdown. We talked on those podcasts, those 2 to 3 podcasts, on what some of those breakdowns were and what caused some of those breakdowns. So that's the same thing here. Now we're looking at lymphedema and inflammation. Something's going to break down. When inflammation stays long enough in the body, something's going to break down. And now it goes to, what is your predisposition for something to break down? It may be lymphedema. It may be a joint disease. It may be a various type of arthritis. It may be a neurological disorder. It's the predisposition that comes after this chronic long-term inflammation that you have created primarily dietarily. That's where 95% is. And then after that, you look for environmental reasons. And so the dietary then predisposes you to getting certain excess, usually of crap, bad foods, non-nutritious foods. And dietary means you're going to then establish by the way you eat long-term chronic nutritional deficiencies. So it's usually the deficiencies that drive or begin the inflammation and start feeding it. So that's sort of the ball that's at the center of this. So to lipedema, what would I say from somebody in front of me? You know, would I recite back to them what they already know about their condition? No, I would pretty much doing what the same focus what we do with our coaching group is that I want to know certain blood work. So that's very important. Not just inflammation, but that's key. I look for other things. You now know my list, but anyways, I have a panel. I would have them do a panel. You know, how bad is their autoimmune, et cetera. So you measure these things. Data is important. Then I'd go into finding out what are their nutritional deficiencies, because I can address those mostly temporarily through supplementation, but also changing their dietary patterns and saying, these are better sources of foods. These are taking out, these are bringing in. And you make them have that. You help them have that transition. So that's how we do that. Third, I would look at their hormones. Why wouldn't I look at their hormones? We know this is a hormone sensitive by gender base alone, but also the association of other factors as well. And then last, we would look at genes being the genome, look at what SNPs would play into their particular situation. So we can throw out words like, well, methylation. And there's a number of things for methylation. That's back to the homocysteine topics I've talked about previously and the whole work of Kilmer McCauley. So you have to put this sandwich of data together, in my view. I think it's malpractice not to do that, frankly. When in running a practice, the problem about running a practice is you have a limited period of time to convey a point of action for this particular person to take. And if something is too global, too overwhelming, they're just not going to start. You might have the right answer. You might be the edge of the edge and you are the person that they need to talk to, but you need to give them a therapeutic point of action that they can take. And then the next appointment, you increase that as you go. That's how you treat people. So the difference between being patient-centered in that sort of practice setting is different than a coaching program. A coaching program, you look at the whole thing and then you slice out what needs to be done and you bring them in, these particular people pre-qualified, you bring them in to give them a result that's much more efficient. That's what I like about coaching now versus sitting across from patients. Anyways, a little bit of digression, but I think you need to know that because often people go, well, I saw Dr. such and such, and this is what they said. Well, in that narrow period of time, they need to give you a small answer so you can then progress onto the next thing, depending if it's an MD, conventionally minded MD versus an alternative / functional medicine type orientation and talking to you. So that's why I mention those things, because often those who have lipedema are very acutely aware of the diagnosis and what's necessary, and they certainly know what hurts. So now let's get to low carb, high fat in the application of the ketogenic diet. And by the way, I don't work in this world in isolation. And for anybody, you can go on YouTube, and I found there's a number of presentations, a number of women who are now coaching other women relative to beginning the low-carb, high-fat approach to lipedema and lymphedema as well. And often those are overlapping conditions. So why would they do that? You know, whether you want to call it keto, and keto is any low-carb, high-fat diet that is low enough for you, and this varies on a per-person basis, is low enough for you to generate ketones. So where, and over a long period of time, what happens in a month is really almost inconsequential. If what happens in 2 months, in 6 months, in a year out is very consequential because it takes a while for you to transition to teach your mitochondria, is the way I look at it, that, hey, you're a serious fat burner. So you've given up carbs for the most part, right? So if you have to drop down to a medically therapeutic ketogenic diet, which is 20 carbs per day, versus more than that, then that's up to you. That's where I am, and I'm even less than that. And you find, and you make life work within that, and it's not terrible. It's a bit of a transition. You feel like, oh, I can't have all these things. I didn't say that. I said these are parameters that you're trying to bring in for yourself, and you could be a dark green leafy vegetable kind of car person. That's fine. Make it organic, by the way. You don't want to be bringing in pesticides and so on and so forth. So a lot of people do that, and I'm not arguing one way or the other. I came from my perspective, and I know it works for me, which made me dive in to look for all the nuanced things for this diet and all its applications. But the heart of why you would consider doing, I'm going to call it all that, a ketogenic diet, is because ketones are anti-inflammatory. Ketones are anti-inflammatory. So if you have now I'm thinking on a very general level now, but yet it's very transformative, is that you have an inflammatory-based condition, lymphedema, then taking a globally anti-inflammatory approach would be a good idea. Previously, people would say, oh, you're on an anti-inflammatory diet, and I'm not talking about keto, and that would mean they would swap out foods that are primarily processed foods that are known to be more inflammatory. And then they would work at your fish oils, your omega-3 and your omega-6s, you know, bring those ratios down to 1 to 3, always more of the 6. But, you know, most Americans, and so if I went to 10 women and did some basic blood work and looking at their omega-3 to 6 ratios, my guess is their ratio would probably be 1 to 20. They would be overwhelmed with omega-6s. And then you'd have to go, what are the sources of those omega-6s? But more importantly, can you bring some fish into this person's life, fish oils into the person's life secondarily? And these are the things that are very also anti-inflammatory. So when you start looking at a few global changes that you can make over time, you will have some profound changes. So I've seen this. I haven't seen scores of lipedema. I think I must have had 1 or 2 patients in all of my practice, but you got to see how they improved. Unfortunately, I was not knowledgeable enough to bring in the ketogenic diet. I brought in these other things and saying they in themselves. So if you want to say you're addressing the comorbidities, does that sound fancy enough for you? I would say you're addressing some of the contributing factors by going through almost a generic list of ticking off things that you know the body needs to change. So if you come and you do your labs and you see certain egregious nutritional deficiencies, and you at least, your focus is at least bring them up to not being deficient anymore, you're going to find a tremendous difference. You know, and after that, you'll have to adjust the dosage, or hopefully you've transformed them, migrated them onto a whole foods diet. If they are people that had processed foods in your diet, that's an easy thing to remove. Not easy to implement in the sense that they probably have an addiction, sorry to use that word, for those particular foods, but you have to make those transitions. So what I find is the one advantage you have when you're dealing with anybody who's in pain is that their pain is the driving motivation. So when you can address directly, this is going to help your pain, this is going to help your pain, then they'll listen and they'll do that. So it's a little bit like, as I say, the most compliant patients I have ever had are cancer patients. Because they're saying, when you say this is directly going to help your immune system and show them the studies and or speak from your experience, they're going to listen and they're going to implement that. You know, if you said you're going to go on a plywood diet and you're confident, I'm being facetious here, and then the confident that will help their adherence, their compliance is always 100%. They will do what you tell them to do, providing they have confidence. So that's the kind of compliance you have with that patient population. When you then go into the general pain population, pick a condition. So now we're talking about lymphedema, and you're directly saying these things are going to help. You have to clean up their lifestyle. I mean, we can generalize and say clean up your lifestyle, but it comes down to very specific, and you can clean up their lifestyle by looking at the labs. That you have to look at that. I so have a pet peeve about those saying, oh, too many labs. I think labs are wonderful, not again and again, just to feel you got something to do, you need something to do and spend the patient's money. No, you get that lens of tests that I've already talked about. And from there, you basically have the holism of what you need to treat. So yes, lifestyle elements are very much part of that. So now you have a more articulated list of what you need to address in this particular person. So panel, nutrient deficiencies, hormones, and then genome analysis. And you pick out the bigger areas in the genome analysis. Don't let that be another rabbit hole and set people on to the paranoia that they have to address every little snip with some particular supplement. No. Don't do that. Okay, so now you've seen the approach, and now we're pretending you're the person that has lymphedema, then you do need to address, we talked about lifestyle, and so you can spend a long time with lifestyle. That really comes up with how your labs look, right? So if you're fine on the omega-3 to 6 panel, then obviously it's not going to be something I'm going to change. If your liver function test comes up, I'm going to have to address that. If there's a number of things that will pop out, I would definitely look at, you know, what is your fasting insulin glucose? What is your triglycerides to HDL? And then there's various formulas. That's, to me, that is a safe formula for insulin resistance. That's pretty much the thing you need to address. If you can drop the insulin down, so it's almost superfluous because you're burning fat, your insulin really doesn't have to come out. Not only will you save your pancreas and give it the rest it's been yearning for all of your life, more likely, and give your liver the rest it's been yearning for all of your life, more than likely, but you will then have achieved a real opening of inflammation, an opening that it's really about beginning to heal, to reverse the situation that's been established. So some will be looking at this by saying, this is way too complicated. I don't know how to do that. And by the way, I know it's genetically oriented, and these are the genes that need to be addressed. Well, to me, I find that a little bit too esoteric. And those things are true when you have cases that have gone so far. But this is a general approach that needs to be implemented before you get to the specific things. That's how I look at it. So if someone's being treated genetically and yet their omega-3, 6 is off and yet their inflammatory markers are still high, then I think that's malpractice. You know, that's the cart before the horse. Okay? So now you started looking at these. What else would you look at? Certainly when you looked at the hormone panel, you get to sort of see how their adrenals are as well as the ratio of their sex hormones and so on and so forth. So these are things that are addressable. And I don't just mean hormone replacement therapy for men and or women. You get to see the context, and there's a lot you can do by lifestyle and some specific supplementation. It is worthwhile, but then you watch these changes. The other thing is you would probably want to look at, you know, now we're talking about inflammation. It's almost open-ended in that you ask, so what is the cause of this inflammation? I bet you thought, I already told you the cause of lipedema, that something happened around puberty and that's what happened in these particular women. No, we don't know what the thing was. We kind of know when the time of the genesis of this thing was. So what is that? And let's pretend now for this particular generic lipedema woman, for the most part, and some men, that we remove the environmental toxins. That's a separate issue that can be followed up. It's a little bit more detailed, gnarly, if you will. We push that out to the side. Well, we don't know what the what is. And for all we know, the what was a predisposition to inflammation that basically triggered hormones, estrogen sensitivity, et cetera, to not have a normal response. And so if you can go back to finding what the cause is, and you'll probably never be able to find the cause for lymphedema, but you'll be able to reduce the inflammation. But still, and so you could say, now to bring it up to something even a little more simple, is that we're simply removing the causes, or simply removing the obstacles to cure. That's one of the naturopathic principles, by the way. And so if you can do that, you're cleaning up the metabolism. So ketones are a big deal. I think ketones specifically and dramatically saved my life and have put my wife's brain tumor in remission times, 7 years are we out now? And even some improvement. So that's impossible. That's for meningioma. Now I'm transitioning here. For meningioma, That's nearly impossible. There has not been any documented evidence of an improvement of a situation. I don't think she'll get her sight back in her right eye, but it has improved to an extent, comparing year to year. That's pretty impressive. Very impressive. But the damage was already done, to the most part. So this is the approach. And the approach is removing obstacles to cure. Lifestyle, you know, looking at what can be changed in the lifestyle. We did the four panels we talked about, and you go through that, you have a lot of things you can change. So we are addressing the comorbidities, we're addressing the contributing factors, and they collectively lead to a huge change. And I would say the biggest driver of all those changes are creating ketones and increasing ketones and transitioning to that lifestyle of being a fat burner. You're helping your mitochondria. That's really the source of all the diseases. So they call it mitochondrial disorders, one through a bazillion. It's partially helpful, but it is true. That's the center of, if things aren't working out for the mitochondria and we don't know how they got there, you're going to have one of a bazillion different types of mitochondrial diseases. So lipedema, you know, lipid is what we're talking about, fat. And I just said that if we can turn somebody into a fat burner, don't you think that's an unusual coincidence? It's a really kind of a key coincidence in the title itself, in the diagnosis? Absolutely. So you could say it is a fat problem. It's a mitochondrial fat problem. So that's where I would put my emphasis on it. But what I was getting to before is one of the things that you could do is to look at food sensitivities. So we're back to those causes, right? That's where I kind of trailed off a little while back, is that you, and there are food sensitivity. We used to do this a lot, but back before keto in the practice, you're opening up kind of a Pandora's box because there's a number of places that you can get these testings done. Great Plains, Genova, used to be called Great Smokies. And there's many. Dr. Data do that now, but they do a lot of other tests that we've used them for. That the list was so long that it's like, oh my gosh, you know, you've just overwhelmed this person. You know, it's like, well, I can't eat anything according to that list. So what we would do is kind of a standard protocol for most conditions. We would start with what they call an elimination diet. So the elimination diet is really based around six commonly sensitive foods. So that would be the wheat, that would be the dairy, that we'd even go eggs, certainly nuts are on it, soy is on it, and I'm probably missing one that I can't think of right now. But these are the things you'd have, and there is a formal document and a formal diet called the elimination diet. And so implementing that is probably one of the hardest things to do, and yet I saw the greatest benefit across the board, regardless of how or why somebody came to see me. If I simply, now you've already known this, some people think I have an attitude about dairy, but all I can say is after 16 years of sitting across from people, that's the one thing they all agreed on is like, take out dairy and my condition got better. Is that so? But looking at the whole elimination diet, you take these out for 2 months and then you bring them back in one at a time with time spaced apart so they don't overlap, and you get a sense of how was it bringing back in dairy? How was it bringing back in wheat? How was it bringing back in egg? How, you know, et cetera. That was a big deal. And here you are dealing with such general things as just elimination diet. It was just a short form of taking out the most commonly problematic foods and one's lifestyle, and then bringing him back in. And usually you found a big deal there. There's one or two, and you can sort of say it's dairy or wheat. For the most part, that's probably what it's going to be, or something else. And you can then look at their food sensitivity test, say if there are a few things there, forget about the why they're sensitive. That's an interesting question and an interesting story for another time, another place. But you could choose the top most egregious, because they're usually ranked by sensitivity or most insensitive to. Or you're most sensitive to, and then you would add them to the elimination diet. Or you could then make an elimination diet based just on those particular foods. So it's up to you, but the category of eliminating certain offensive foods that trigger your immune system to go bonkers is not a bad philosophy, is not a bad treatment therapy. And it is something that is disproportionately beneficial, disproportionately beneficial. It might not be as sexy as they say as a particular supplement that drives a particular reaction in your mitochondria or in your gut, so on and so forth. but it's pretty close. It's probably one of the most effective things you can do. So once you get that done, and now you have, all right, things are better, then you start adding to the next thing. So you have eliminating the most egregious foods. You have getting your labs done. You have certainly the ketogenic diet. Now you've introduced the biggest anti-inflammatory in the world in the sense of getting your body to be fat adapted enough so you can produce ketones. And so in my experimentation, you know, you have MCT oils. C8 is dramatically helpful. It's a saturated fat, and it's one of the most unresearched. There's some research out there. So put in C8 MCT oil in PubMed or Google Scholar, and you'll see. But the problem is there's no patent on it. So you're just not going to see a lot of research on that. You probably see some research coming out now about exogenous ketones. Big financial powers behind that now. Pharmaceutical companies are jumping in hand over fist. A lot of money. So you have natural versus unnatural. You have the concept of saturated fats. And if everybody's going, oh, saturated fats, we're not supposed to have that, I will insert, please read Nina Teicholz's book, Big Fat. I want to say Big Fat Lies. It's not Big Fat. Big Fat Surprise. It's all about the misinformation over the past 60 years of saturated fats. And when people talk about saturated fats, I find it very ignorant just to leave it at saturated fats. You have short chain saturated fats, medium chain saturated fats, and long chain saturated fats. Short chain, and you also can say fatty acids. So short chain fatty acids are the ones that are generated by your bowel. The fiber, the idea you needed fiber in your bowel to create butyrate. Butyrate is a short chain fatty acid, and it's a step away from beta hydroxybutyrate, which is a ketone. So that's a really interesting connection, don't you think? So that's where the short chain fatty acids came from. Then you go to medium chain fatty acids, which are between C6 and C12. C8 is the most effective and most quickly fastest to create ketones. And so working some of that into your mayonnaise or putting a little bit of that onto your food, you've now made a pretty easy transition to a ketogenic diet, a ketone producing diet. I wouldn't use that as a crutch, but I think it's a great condiment that is very healthy for people to drop their inflammation and to start producing ketones. We still use it. I use it a lot less. But now having my Freestyle Libra, a continual glucose monitor, I can monitor how effective C8 is in dropping my glucose level. So it produced the ketones. My body said, hey, I'm going to burn the ketones instead of the glucose. So my glucose dropped even lower to switch over, which means my insulin dropped even lower. So everybody can do that. Really interesting that it is that dynamic. So, but you get the gist, okay? The big picture is we're anti-inflammatory. We gave you some tools of what to do and why to do it. I didn't want to get into, you know, to show you that I can recite the basic information of lipedema. I think it's a little better to say, these are some things you can do. There's certainly, go on YouTube, and there's already some testimonies by some authentic people. Should you want to do that? And they're basically saying the same thing. And they're going to say the most important thing they've ever done is to go to a ketogenic diet, and you can then tease out from their presentations how many carbs and what kind of carbs was that about. Did they have to go down to 20? Did they go down to carnivore or zero carb? And what were the differences there? So that's out there. But I'm saying in addition to that, you can probably double your benefit by looking at the panels, your fish oils, removing processed foods. And for some of you, that's probably going to have to deal with some addiction issues, but that's the way out of this. Absolutely, that is the way out of this. So I hope that's been, you know, something that you can go do. And, you know, I'll link a few presentations here, but I think it's unnecessary. Just go YouTube and type in lipedema, lipedema presentations, lipedema low carb. That's really all you need to do, and to the degree that you use that for any sort of your research. And there's some good things out there. You know, it's amazing how YouTube has become this world of, if there's anything you want to know, it's there in video. So with that, I'm going to close. And I think, you know, for those who have been listening from the very beginning, we have evolved from working with people for free just on changing the macros of their diet. And so now we're way up with, I call the lens of lab panels, right? The four that I told you about, changing their macros and obviously in that choosing better quality of those macros, which basically means improving their lifestyle, pretty much as I described here. So it's a general approach for lipedema, but it's our approach to a lot of situations, and it's dramatic how profound that is. Environmentally, we do ask people about what they've been exposed to, and this would go to anybody about lipedema. We would say, you know, tell me about your childhood. Where did you grow up geographically? You know, what do you remember were things that you were exposed to, and you know, what was your diet and so on and so forth. So for instance, if somebody grew up on a diet of tuna or swordfish, because they had that, very few people do that, by the way, I would have a mercury, long-term chronic mercury exposure and probably a saturated number of fat cells that have had mercury in them for the longest time. Yeah, you could say mercury from amalgams as well, but I'm more looking for the other. That would be an obvious, in my word, an obvious issue that would also have to be treated separately apart from anything I've said here. But you at least have identified it. You identify other things. That biohistory, you know, if they grew up on a farm and they remember the flyover planes, you know, dropping the pesticides two or three times a year over their house, and so they grew up in that cloud of pesticides two or three times a year times 15 years, well, that's a pretty significant factor that you've now discovered. So you get my perspective. I think you had some useful information here. Feel free to send in some of your questions if you think this has been too general, but I hope this has been useful to the majority of you. Okay, take care. Till next time. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Dr. Goldkamp. I just wanted to encourage you to send in your questions to drgoldkamp@ketonaturopath.com. Many of you have, and so what I've done with these questions that gotten back to most of the people I email, but some of the questions that were so good, and if they were overlapping to other questions, I would combine them and try to put that into the topic of a podcast, either via one of the micro topics that are covered in an interview. As you know, we cover a lot of topics in any given interview, or some of my own sort of reporting, if you will, on some of these issues. So please keep the questions coming. Feel free to send in an email, and I will get back to you. One thing I want to say, a number of questions have come in which I've given this answer, and the email didn't work. So just make sure that you're receiving at the same email that you sent it in. And I think that might have been the difficulty. So I look forward to your questions. I just wanted to make sure that you knew that I'm hoping to answer your questions. And I think this world of keto is not just black and white. You know, it's nice that it's simple, but it's not simple for some. I'm really trying to, you know, go down, as anybody, any of you who have listened to all my podcasts, we started way back when, history of evolution and epilepsy and so on and so forth. You know, now we're seeing some tremendous overlap in various mental disorders, such as schizophrenia or neurological disorders that are not just epilepsy. And also, just for people in losing weight, it's sometimes pretty complicated for them to engage in keto, and so they need some help. And so that's the whole point of, at least that's what I think I'm doing, is exploring the world of why are there other factors. So in exploring some of those other factors, we've covered addiction, we've covered hormones, we've covered nutritional deficiencies, we've covered certain metabolic lab results, and we'll go further. We'll even get to more on genome and aspects. So these are all just contributions that make for an obstacle for some people to engage easily in the ketogenic diet. This is my belief, and these are the things that I've discovered, and I think other people have discovered some of these things, but not ever put them together. So stay listening, send in your questions, and I will definitely get back to you.